is William Skinner, and I represent the appellant, the May Department Stores Company, and the May Department Stores Company Retirement Plan. This case presents three questions. One, the jurisdictional issue that the court has noted. Two, the question whether an exclusion and an insurance policy that applies to benefits due under the terms of the plan should be interpreted as applying also to plans to benefits that were not due under the terms of the plan but under ERISA. And the third question is whether National Union should have been permitted to deny coverage on grounds of late notice without showing beyond factual dispute either that notice was unreasonably late under the circumstances or that it had suffered prejudice. And I propose to deal with those questions in that order.
Well, before you do that, with regard to this jurisdictional matter, I must say it's kind of surprising that the law firms should all have overlooked this rather conspicuous jurisdictional issue. But in any event, with regard to your suggestion that we just drop the retirement plan, isn't the retirement plan the insured here?
Both are insured. The policy was purchased by the May Department Stores Company. It is
okay.
Purchased.
So the retirement plan is insured. So now what? We drop it? Is it gonna bring its own case or what?
No, Your Honor. Under Rule 17, the language says that where one company here the company May Company buys makes a contract, which benefits another party here the May plan. The company that made the contract, May Company, has the right under Rule 17 to bring the action both for its own benefit and for the benefit of the third party, the May plan, without joining the May plan as a party. And we think that Rule 17 expressly permits the May Company to go forward with this case on its own behalf and also on behalf of the May plan, and that without having the May plan be a party.
Now, say that again. How does the May Company get the right to sue on behalf of the plan?
Because Rule 17 says so.
Rule 17 says what?
Rule 17 says that where one company, one party, here the May Company, makes a contract that also benefits a third party, the contract here was between the May Department Stores Company and the insurers. May Department Stores Company was the contracting party. The contracts benefit both May Company and the May plan, so the May plan is a beneficiary of the contract. But Rule 17 says
May plan is not a party?
The May plan is now a party, but Rule 17 says it does not have to be a party, that the May company could bring the action on behalf of the May plan without joining the third party as a party.
So are you focusing on language in the contract? I'm not sure whether I should be looking at tab 3 of your brief, that the contract of insurance only mentions May company.
No. The contract of insurance makes crystal clear that it was the May Department Stores Company that entered into the contract.
Okay. They're the ones who signed the contract, and you're saying plainly the plan is a...
is also insured. Lots of people are insured. The company is insured. The plan is insured. The individual employees are insured.
Okay.
But Rule 17 says that when somebody has made a contract for the benefit of another, that the party that made the contract can sue for the benefit of the other without joining the other person as a party. And so we're saying under that rule, it is not necessary to have the May plan part of it, and that the May company can go forward with this litigation both on its own behalf and on behalf of the May plan. It's very important that the May company be allowed to continue on behalf of the May plan because the May plan suffered the major part of the loss and is seeking the major compensation from the insurance companies. But we say Rule 17 allows it to go forward on that basis. There is another theory which Federal came up with, which leads to the same result, which is that...
I didn't say that in Rule 17. I'm really confused by this. I wish you'd noticed it when you wrote your brief.
Well, Your Honor, where I see it in Rule 17 is a party with whom
where,
or in whose name...
Where are you reading?
Rule 17A. A party with whom or in whose name a contract has been made for the benefit of another. And we say... the contract here was made with the May Department Stores Company and in its name for the benefit of another. The other, in this case, includes the May plan. And the rule goes on to say, may sue in that person's own name, that's the May company's name, without joining the party for whose benefit the action is brought. And that's the May plan. We don't have to join the May plan.
That just, all that says is that May, the company, has a right to sue. It doesn't say anything about whether we should let May Department Store's plan drop out of the case as somehow unimportant.
Oh, no, Your Honor, I understand that. What
you just said was that the May store was the primary victim of the alleged breach of contract of the insurance companies. But you didn't say the May plan doesn't have any claim of its own.
No, quite the opposite. The May plan has a major part of this claim.
So is it going to bring its own suit?
No, Your Honor, but bear with me for a moment. There are some crucial words in May 17. Without joining the party for whose benefit the action is brought. If back in the beginning, May Company could have brought this action both on its own behalf and on behalf of the May plan without joining the May plan under Rule 17. Why is that relevant now? That's relevant now because Newman Green...
Newman Green.
So if this action could originally have been brought by the May Company on its own behalf and on behalf of the May plan, and we say Rule 17...
Well, how could it bring it on behalf of the May plan?
Because Rule 17 says
so. Rule 17 is about procedure. It's not about the substantive rights of these companies. Doesn't the plan have its own rights, its own claims?
It does, Your Honor, but Rule 17 says...
I mean, what are you going to say, that a parent company can bring a suit on behalf of its subsidiaries?
Rule 17 says so. There is another way to get there, Your Honor. The other way to get there is an argument that Federal made, that there is a line of authority that says when you're dealing with an ERISA plan, it is in the nature of a trust, and you look to the fiduciary that is the trustee and its residence. The literal trustee is the Bank of New York, but the real fiduciary for this plan, for these purposes, who has the fiduciary responsibility to make these decisions.
Now that's a good argument, but is that consistent with our cases?
Your cases
say on that view, there's no problem with diversity and no reason to invoke Newman Green.
That's right, Your Honor. Your cases, there are Seventh Circuit cases which do suggest that the person's citizenship you should look to is the trustee. The question is, who is the real trustee?
No, that's not the question.
I'm sorry.
Those cases say, look to the trustee, and the trustee is the Bank of New York. You're not saying who's the real trustee. You're saying who, as a realistic matter, has a stake in this case, and it's not the Bank of New York.
But we'd have to
overrule our cases in order to adopt your approach, although I agree your approach is superior. Well, why don't we move on to something else?
All right. Your Honor, on the merits, we are dealing here with fiduciary liability policies that expressly promise coverage for claims alleging that there has been a violation of ERISA. That's the promise in the front part of the policy. And both of these claims clearly fall within the basic grants of insurance coverage because they were alleging that May and the May plan had violated ERISA.
I must say, I find your argument very hard to buy because I thought what the insurance company said was very powerful, that under your theory, the insured has every incentive to take a very aggressive, even a crazy position on what ERISA requires or doesn't require. And then when pays out very meager benefits on the basis of its crazy interpretation. And then when it's sued and has to pay a huge additional amount in benefits, it turns around and lays that off on the insurance companies. So why on earth would an insurance company ever insure that risk?
Because the insurance company knows well that companies have very powerful incentives not to do that, much more powerful.
What incentives?
Your Honor, the consequences
of... I mean, we see zillions of cases in which companies, ERISA plans and so on, are sued because they made an aggressive and erroneous interpretation of ERISA.
Well, Your Honor, let's look at the words of the contract. They promised to cover the plan for claims of ERISA violations, and they had an exclusion that said, we're only going to cover you if it was a willful, deliberate violation found.
Well, we also have an exclusion for benefits.
Right.
But that's the big exclusion.
Benefits under the terms of the plan. So what does that mean?
Look, under ERISA, as under also, and we just had a case that was published, I think, yesterday, the AEI case. Often statutes, in effect, insert terms into contracts. And the AEI case required certain contract parties to insert to require a bond. Well, similarly, ERISA requires all sorts of things in benefits. The company, the plan or what have you, decides how generous the benefits are, but when it comes to interest and payout and vesting and forms for changing, all sorts of things, ERISA in effect tells the plan what the terms are. They're terms implied by law into the plan, and they determine often the amount of benefits.
Your Honor, ERISA might have done that, but ERISA did not do that. In fact, ERISA does precisely the opposite. ERISA, in various provisions, draws a sharp distinction between failures to comply with the terms of your plan and failures to comply with ERISA. There are different remedial sections. There are different jurisdictional provisions.
You're referring to the remedial sections, I think, in particular in your brief, but I'm concerned also because it seems to me that ERISA is your classic paternalistic statute. It doesn't create default rules that if the parties forgot to negotiate about it, there are certain rules. It says if you're going to have a plan at all, there's some things that simply must be, and I'm very concerned about drawing this sharp distinction when it comes to benefit payments. Your opponents have a footnote in their brief at one point where they say there are plenty of things this insurance clause could have covered, and I presume they're saying does cover, that don't deal with actual payments of benefits under the plan. And they also make the argument that this is really all about what the actuarial value of the age 65 benefit is anyway, which struck me as also something that needed response from you.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree. If they had wanted to write an exclusion, as Continental Casualty did, saying we won't cover if it's benefits due under the plans or applicable law, we won't cover that. They could have written that. Continental Casualty did. ERISA does not equate the terms of the plan with all these other rules. Under ERISA, I mean, this is an insurance contract case. Is it reasonable in the English language, which is the standard under insurance law, to say that the terms of the plan mean something different than the terms of the plan plus ERISA and all of its regulations?
But the terms of the plan need to be interpreted to a certain degree, and if you have a term like actuarial equivalent of the age 65 benefit, then ERISA steps in and limits the discretion of the plan administrator in how to achieve that. You can't throw away the actuarial tables. You've got to do it in a certain way.
But that is a defined term in the May plan, and it defines it, at least from 1990 to 1994, with reference to the PBGC immediate rate. It was not defined with reference to ERISA. It was defined specifically in the plan. And in the Asbury case, there was absolutely nothing in the plan that said, we have to give you a notice when you turn 65, or if we don't give you a notice, you're going to get an actuarial increase when you retire. That comes outside of the plan from an argument about a Department of Labor regulation.
So are you asking us to overrule all these cases, such as the one Judge Posner was referring to, that in various contexts indicate that statutes can have provisions that, if you will, absorb into contracts?
No. I think that most of those cases, Your Honor, if I'm correct, have involved state law, and have said that under state law, which is not preempted, to the extent it's not preempted, certain provisions may be required in insurance plans, and they become part of the plan de jure under state law. ERISA is very different. ERISA does not say, and it is careful not to say, that all of ERISA regulations and requirements are automatically incorporated into plans. And the reason we know it doesn't say that is because throughout the remedial sections and the jurisdictional sections and the way the IRS enforces this.
The suits that you settled were suits for benefits.
Under ERISA, we say, Your Honor, not under the terms of the plan.
Well, but ERISA doesn't create benefits. Plans create benefits.
Sure, Your Honor, but once ERISA, I mean, if we didn't have a plan, there would be no benefits and nothing to argue about. But once a plan is created.
That's a very important point.
I understand
right?
that.
You can't sue for benefits under ERISA. You have to have a plan.
Yes,
but ERISA tells you, to some extent, what the benefits are worth.
Your Honor, I appreciate the starting point is the plan, but ERISA confers lots of benefits, and there is a distinction. And there is a difference of risk. And we are dealing with an insurance contract and transferring risk, and it was sold on the basis. ERISA is very hard to compare.
So what's the premium?
I don't remember, Your Honor. It would be reflected, I believe, in the exhibit.
Because, you know, we keep saying in our cases, no one pays any attention, but we keep saying that it's helpful in interpreting a contract to know what the consideration was. Because if someone is suing for $1 billion and it turned out that, you know, in insurance, and it turned out he pays a $100 annual premium, that's a reason to doubt that the particular risk was covered. Now, your suggestion here is that this insurer, of course, there is a limit, the $25 million, but the implication is that this is a very encompassing insurance policy, and that's why I'm curious how much you pay for this coverage.
Your Honor, I don't know the answer here, but the same argument could have been made in all the comprehensive general liability policies. They were very profitable from 1940 to 1975, and then all of the latent injury claims came to light, and the insurance company...
Sure, but there one sees what the problem is. You don't have this here, right?
Maybe not, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Skinner. Mr. Verschelden?
May it please the Court, I'm Matt Verschelden, representing Federal Insurance Company. And, Your Honor, I believe that Your Honors have identified my principal argument. When you look at this benefits due exclusion, it says we are not covering benefits due or become due under the terms of the plan. And the principal way, and I believe the most persuasive way of getting to an interpretation of what that means, is to ask, what was the benefit due under the terms of the plan? And that benefit was the age 65 benefit. That was the annuity commencing at age 65 that the plan promised to these folks. The Asbury folks who retired after age 65 and the Seifert folks who were terminated VESTA participants and received their benefit in a lump sum payment at, say, age 52. That is what the plan promised to those people. That was the benefit that was due under the terms of the plan. And the only role of ERISA is to make sure that when the plan calculates what the actuarial equivalent of that is, that they do not use, in the case of Seifert, an aggressive interest rate to pay them less than the full value of their age 65 benefit.
We're just focused on Judge Posner's question on premium. What, in fact, would this provision pay for? What, give me an example of what it would pay for.
Judge Mannion, let me do that, and let me answer Judge Posner's question, because
okay.
I do have notes about what the premiums were. They were $85,477 for the first year and $76,547 for the second year. It was a two-year policy. Mm-hmm. And for that, they got insurance coverage, the primary insurance policy, of $25 million.
Could I ask you just to review a little further what you think this coverage actually did give, if it doesn't give what May Department Stores is asking for?
Yes, and I take it that to be the same question that Judge Manning had.
Yeah.
There are a series of risks that are insured by this policy. First of all, it covers defense costs, so that even in a benefit claim that clearly there would be no liability for the benefits, there wouldn't be any indemnity liability, it does cover defense costs.
I had wondered, did you pay them in these cases? Is that just something that happened that's not an issue here?
The defense costs did not reach the $500,000 deductible on either case.
Okay.
But we did provide a defense. There isn't any question about that. We provided the defense in both Seifert and Asbury. It's just the defense cost didn't reach the deductible.
So you're not asking for your defense cost back. So this defense cost is separate from the insurance?
Benefits, yeah.
Well, you're usually just usually duty to defend, duty to indemnify are the same, except that you resolve doubts in favor of the duty to defend, even if indemnity isn't proved. But are you saying there's a defense obligation here that goes beyond the indemnification?
Your Honor, let me see if I can answer it, and if I don't, you tell me. The May paid, it may...
No, maybe I'm being vague, but we often see a case where the insurance company has provided defense and paid for defense, because there was an arguable claim for indemnity.
Yes.
If it's not arguable, then there's no duty to pay defense costs.
Right, Your Honor, but actually the insureds paid the defense costs. They would pay the insurance costs until they reached the deductible.
But I'm looking at page 28 of the appendix where it says the company, which is you, shall not be liable for that part of loss other than defense costs, which constitutes benefits due or to become due. So in other words, you're saying that this contract happens to have been written in a way that says you will cover the defense costs in a benefits case no matter what.
Yes, subject to the deductible, the $500,000.
Right. Subject to the deductible.
Yeah. That was the problem. Is the deductible was never reached for defense costs. So the federal insurance.
Okay. So in other words, you're giving them this little sort of pourboire, $500,000 in defense costs, even though it's not an indemnifiable loss.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's just one thing. Let me move on. There are other things that are covered. It also covers, even in a benefits context, if a fiduciary were held personally liable for the benefit obligation, then that is also covered. And so, to me, I think about this fiduciary liability policy much like a D&O policy, where if you're going to ask employees of a company to serve as fiduciaries, they might expect, just like a director and officer might expect, to be covered for any personal liability that would arise from that service. There is that coverage. There's also many instances where a fiduciary may invest the plan assets and invest them unwisely and be sued for that.
Well, how is that different from what you just said about personal liability? It's just a way in which a fiduciary gets into trouble, right?
Yes, and I was just giving some examples of where there would be coverage. Another case would be a case where a fiduciary were to advise an employee erroneously. And an example, I think, would be if an employee came in and he was considering early retirement, and he went to the plan administrator and said, if I retire today, how much will my benefit be? And let's say under the calculation, it's really $1,000 a month, but the plan administrator says $2,000. I think you would make $2,000 a month, and the employee relies to his detriment on that, and there's a lawsuit. And the question is he entitled, under some theory, to $2,000 as opposed to the $1,000 that he would be due under the terms of the plan? That would be a covered event under both indemnity as well as cost of defense. And let me throw out a disclaimer here. Obviously, nothing I can say here, I wouldn't want it written down that Federal Insurance Company, the lawyer for Federal, made binding representations on Federal about when there would be coverage and everything, but this is not an illusory policy. There are lots of things that are covered that are not set aside by the benefits due exclusion. The fact of the matter is nobody insures benefits due. And I mean, except maybe the federal government. The PBGC steps into that arena, but there's no insurer that covers benefits due. The other thing, when I talked about the age 65 benefit, that I think is telling is that in the underlying litigation, in the Seifert and Asbury litigation, in defending that litigation, May took this position and took it in the strongest terms. It is clear, it is beyond doubt, that these were claims for benefits due under the terms of the plan. That's what they said, and what they were talking about, what Seifert and Asbury and May were talking about, was it's the age 65 benefit that was the benefit due under the terms of the plan. They also, in their VCR submission in April of 1997, which was a sworn submission, May articulated why it owed actuarial increases to these Asbury class members. And there, they said it was due under the terms of the plan, and what they identified was for these people to get the age 65 benefit that they've been promised, under the terms of the plan, we should have been paying actuarial increases.
Well, there you're talking about the interest computation, correct? But what about this notice business? The age 65 people, they weren't given notice that, they weren't going to get additional benefits if they kept on working. Is that something like that?
Yeah.
So how does that become a benefit under the plan?
Your Honor, these people were promised under the terms of the plan the age 65 benefit. And what happens is under ERISA, ERISA says that if you send out this notice, if you structure your plan so that you're sending out this notice, and what you're saying is if you send the notice when these people continue to work past age 65, you can suspend the payments of benefits during the time that they're employed after age 65 and not make them up. So that's
right, you're warning them of this.
Yes.
So they don't keep on working in the hope that they're getting more benefits. Okay.
Exactly. You could do that. And what happens under ERISA is ERISA says that if you do that, that will not be considered a forfeiture. That's one of the few exceptions there are under ERISA where that age 65 benefit that you're promised, that you can essentially have a permissible forfeiture. That did not occur here. And therefore, those benefits, the age 65 benefit, needed to be paid.
Could I ask you quickly to address Mr. Skinner's argument that Section 502A1 and 502A3 of ERISA really do reflect the distinction that he's arguing for between a plan and ERISA?
Yes, Your Honor. And that really comes down to, and I'd like to introduce another case, and that's the Plum case, because another way of looking at this, the age 65 is the key, but another way of looking at this would be as in the Plum case, where it was a case brought under 502A1B of ERISA, and the court asked this question, okay, what are the terms of the plan? ERISA says you get to recover benefits due under the terms of the plan under 502A1B. What are the terms of the plan? And the court there said, well, of course, it would be the written words in the plan document. But it also includes terms that essentially are implied by law.
By law, the incorporation form.
Yes.
Okay. Which leaves what for A3?
A3 would be kind of a catch-all provision that you can sue for appropriate equitable relief. And
cases, maybe.
Yes. I mean, and so I think that the important point is that you can get there through the benefits due under the terms of the plan, and that case gets you there by asking what are the terms of the plan, and it includes terms that are implied by law, and in fact that's a very familiar concept under the law. And is that when you say terms under the plan, that it doesn't say express terms, it doesn't say actual terms, it doesn't say written terms. What it says is terms, and that can include both express and implied. Your Honor, there are other examples that I could give as to what this plan covers, but in instances where fiduciaries have made mistakes, and there is still coverage that is beyond that is not kicked out by the benefits due provision. Your Honor, let me. My red light has gone on. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sheldon. Mr. Paik.
May it please the Court, Lisa Paik representing the excess carrier National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The District Court also granted summary judgment to National Union on the additional independent ground of late notice. In seeking reversal of that judgment here, May is asking the Court to ignore the fact that the policies at issue here were expressly stated to be claims-made policies.
That's not quite a fair characterization. They freely acknowledge it's claims made, but some claims made policies say, and you have to submit the claim within 30 days of the end of the period, and others have much more general language like yours. I think that they're asking us to address, let's say, two different subsets of claims made policies.
Yes, Your Honor. The Missouri courts, including the Missouri Supreme Court in the Whitner-Poger case, have identified a claims-made policy as being one which requires that the claim be made against the insured within the policy period. That's the policy we have here. There are different subsets of claims-made policies, including what's called a claims-made and reported policy,
right,
which requires notice also to go to the insurer within the policy period.
That's the point.
And that, exactly. That policy language is not here. What this policy required was that first the claim be made against the insured within the policy period, and then that notice be given as soon as practicable.
Right, and the whole legal question is, in your kind, which doesn't have that nice clean language about, you know, either claims made and reported, or some of those policies recognize that if the claim arose on the last day of the policy period or something, there's usually a little bit of a grace period. Your plan has much more general language, and the question is whether the prejudice rule applies when the more general language is used, even if the prejudice rule does not apply if the claims made and reported type is before us.
Yes, Your Honor, and we submit that under Missouri law that the Missouri courts would not apply a prejudice requirement here. Again, the Missouri courts have defined a claims made policy as one where the claim is made against the insured within the policy period.
But have they actually focused on the exact question we have?
They have not had this precise language before them. The closest case, I think, applying Missouri law would be the Lexington Insurance versus St. Louis University case in the Eighth Circuit, where there also was, in a later part of the policy, a specific reporting requirement, but it wasn't included within the definition of the coverage under claims made. In that case, the insured argued that because the language was broken up, then it should really be treated more as an occurrence policy. The Eighth Circuit declined to do that and continued to treat it as a claims made policy and did not require prejudice. The Tanovsky case out of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, which we've cited in our brief, did address our type of policy language and construed it to be a claims-made policy with no requirement of prejudice, saying to do differently would give the insured something it had not paid or bargained for. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Paik. Mr. Skinner, how much time do you have? You can have, we'll give you a minute. So.
I ask the court to approach this case from the perspective that what you're being asked to do is to interpret words in an insurance policy under the legal principles that apply to an insurance policy. And the policy promises up front coverage for violations of ERISA. And the exclusion is for benefits due under the terms of the plan. And under the principles applicable to insurance policies, the question is it at least reasonable to say that there is a difference between the terms of the plan and all the requirements of ERISA and the regulations. And we say it is at least reasonable to do this. It is not bizarre, in the words of the Seventh Circuit, which is the test. They have to show it's bizarre for us to say that there's a difference. Why is it at least reasonable? Because ERISA draws that distinction. In the English language, the terms of the plan would reasonably be understood to be the terms of the document, the words of the document. If I told you the terms of your employment contract, it's the words of the document. That's reasonable. ERISA also draws these distinctions in the remedial sections, in the IRS enforcement mechanisms, in the jurisdictional provisions between state and federal court. So we say, under the insurance principles, it is reasonable to make that difference. And the court should not let them out because they think they made a bad contract. If the claims are made policy, they can change their exclusion next year to say, we are going to exclude benefits due under the terms of the plan or applicable law. That's what Continental Casualty has already done. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much.